Here, welcome. If it's your first time to Eretz Yisrael, welcome to the Simcha of Yerushalayim and the Simcha of Hoshana Rabbah. And of course, every Yom Tov is an experience of Simcha. V'aseinu Hashem Elokeinu es berachas mo'adecha, samcheinu b'vinyano, hareinu b'sikuno. But inasmuch as Sukkos isn't really tagged to any one particular event or geography, it isn't weighted down with zman chiruseinu or zman matan taraseinu. It's liberated to be completely dedicated to Simcha. And the end really accelerates. These last 3 days are saturated. Every day is a different theme, a different idea. Tomorrow's Hoshana Rabbah, and the next day is Simchas Torah. And in Israel, we've got to juggle Simchas Torah and Shmini Atzeres jointly. So a lot happening over the next 3 days. And without question, Simchas Torah is an eruption of joy and celebration. But is Simchas Torah permissible? Well, that's a provocative question. Of course, it's permissible, but it's permissible and even warranted and endorsed to dance with the Torah and celebrate the cycle of the Torah. What about when we study Torah? Should Simcha be the prominent emotion, the attitude, the modality? Where should we be? What should our mind space be when we study Torah? So of course that takes us a few steps back. What's the role in joy in general in life, in general in religion, before we telescope Torah? How important should joy be and happiness? And of course, in the modern world, psychology has stressed happiness, alleviated any stressors or tension. And in addition, within the Jewish world, Hasidus placed a great emphasis on Simcha, because the name of Hasidus is not just an ideological movement, it's also a historical movement, and it emerges 1,700 years into a very long galus that had become very protracted, very onerous, 17th, 18th century, very difficult for the Jews of Central Europe. So Hasidus has a message about living in that tunnel, that it may seem dark and it may seem long and it may seem unending, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu is right around the corner in some cosmic world that you can't see. Even though the political world may be a little bit dark and bleak, there's a cosmic calculus that's a little bit larger than life and can't be tracked with human eye, and that's cause for consolation and cause for redemptive hope. So certainly in 2019, most of us would say, well, of course, joy is fundamental to self-esteem, to human welfare, to happiness of being, to success in life. But interestingly enough, the Rambam doesn't suggest an accentuated form of joy. Again, I apologize for the sources, but the Rambam, in the beginning of Hilchos Deos, it's a very interesting theory called the golden mean. Middle road, middle path. A lot of people mistake that. Well, I'm a little bit religious, I'm not that religious, I keep some mitzvot, I'm a Rambam man. I keep some of the mitzvahs. I don't want to be too extreme. I don't want to be fanatical. Those fanatics, those mikvah dippers. I'm not a mikvah dipper. I'm a Rambam man. I keep half the mitzvahs. So I come to shul 10:15 because I want to be middle of the road. The Rambam was referring to personality calibration, not religion, not ritual, not ceremony. How do you calibrate yourself? Should you spend all your money? Should you be very frugal? Should you be talkative or should you be quiet and introverted? Should you... Character calibration. And one of the issues he suggests calibrating is, should you be full of schok and happiness and joy and mirth? Or should you be more serious and not somber, but focused and I'll just read the language. Should you be muhulal v'sochek? Or should you be etzef, sad even, v'onein? And even a bit mournful, I would say maybe melancholy, if not mournful, wistful, longing. The recognition of the realities of life, not just the joy of life, which we read about this morning. And the Rambam suggests that they be calibrated. There are only two traits which the Rambam endorses extremism towards. One is anger and one is humility. You should have absolutely no anger and absolutely no arrogance. Every other trait should be calibrated right along that golden mean. So interestingly enough, the Rambam does not stress unabated, uncompromised, or unqualified simcha. Of course, to understand the Rambam, it's probably important to distinguish between two types of simcha. And each form of simcha has a respective word in our lexicon, in Tanakh, in Chazal, in the Rambam. There's a difference between what the Rambam refers to, when he talks about tzchok, shehei muhulo v'sochek, you shouldn't be tzchok-oriented to an extreme, and the word simcha. I probably define the distinction as follows. Tzchok is probably light, humorous, cheery, mirthful, jovial. And that's an important trait. Sometimes people are too heavy. They're too dark. They walk into the room, they suck out all the oxygen. It's good to have a good sense of humor. It's good to smile. It's good to create mirth, happiness, lightness of being. Not to be weighed down. We all have our troubles in life and tensions, and sometimes we need people and experiences to help us escape them, even temporarily. So lightheadedness, not frivolity in the sense of colus roche, of uncontrolled language or inebriated behavior or inappropriate behavior towards other people, but lightness, easygoing, calm, that's tzchok. And that trait, the Rambam feels, has to be regulated. You should be light, humorous, relaxing other people's tension, but not too extreme. On the other hand, you should be serious of purpose, serious-minded, focused, challenging. As opposed to simcha, and I don't want to use the word happiness tonight because that's too generic and too general and it would dilute the shiur. I would describe simcha not as mirth and cheer, but as an inner satisfaction, inner contentment, gratification, serenity, tranquility, calmness of being, alignment. These are the words I think mature people would think about to describe simcha. Do you feel aligned? Do you feel gratified? Do you feel internally content? And whereas the Rambam encourages us to calibrate tzchok and not to be too jovial, but not to be too serious, it would appear that simcha is an unqualified trait. To appreciate the difference between simcha and tzchok, again, the absence of sources will arrive in Mir Tashem, but there's an interesting section in the beginning of Shmuel Beis in which David HaMelech relocates the Aron twice. There are two attempts to relocate the Aron. At one point, it's in a house of Aminadav, and he relocates it, and there's mass celebrations and dancing. But unfortunately, one of the carriers of the Aron is killed by a Kaddish Baruch Hu, whose name is Uzzah. And in that context, I'll just read the key words for you. This is in Shmuel Beis, Perek Vav. David v'chol Beis Yisrael misachakim lifnei Hashem. You hear the language misachakim? They're dancing, the spirit, there's a lot of lightheadedness. And in part, that lack of gravitas is what leads to this tragic death of one of the Arons. Very similar to Nadav and Avihu. Great day, landmark moment, keystone event, and all of a sudden terrible tragedy to one of the participants in the event. And then a few months later, the Aron is now in the home of a person called Oved, Edom. His name's Oved. And Oved has become very wealthy because he's hosting the Aron, and David now wants to relocate it to Ir David. It's not yet the Beis HaMikdash, but it's Ir David. And at that point, a very different ceremony takes place. Once burned, twice conscious. There's no schok, but the language is they ascend with the Aron besimcha, not schok. And some of the signals of simcha, just before we even get to Talmud Torah, is number one, there's sacrifices. Every couple steps, every six steps, they offer a sacrifice. I'm not sure if that sacrifice is a prayer for the next six steps or gratitude for the previous six steps, because it wasn't the sequel of the previous step. But there's sacrifices. And he's wearing an ephod. It's not the ephod of the Kohen Gadol, because he's not a Kohen. But it's something ceremonious. It's something that's anchored. It's not just unfettered joy. It's anchored in symbolism. It's anchored in iconography. It's anchored in something related to the Beis HaMikdash. There are korbanos. It's the garments of the Kohen. And there's a cold shofar replacing some of the musical instruments that dominated the previous schok. So if you're looking for a yeoman's distinction between schok and simcha, schok would be unfettered, simcha would be symbolic, simcha would evoke something larger than itself, would evoke some other realm, such as the Beis HaMikdash, the Kohen Gadol, the shofar, in a different context, a little bit happier, a little bit more joyous than, let's say, the solemnity of Rosh Hashanah, but it would be evocative, not just empty. So clearly, when the Rambam encourages us to calibrate tzchok, he's referring to tzchok, lightness of being, which is important, but dangerous in the extreme. Simcha, tadar abatzach. I think, David, did you get the phone call yet? Okay, so these are the preliminary makaros. This is just page one. The others are on the way. Tadar abatzach. V'yashakoach kol hashka. Zeh adam shirgenev kol erev, Baruch Hashem. Okay, so please, Akiva and Ned, if you can hand out those sheets, everyone, help them. This is just the first sheet. Those who have the first sheet, Chazal also. Okay, forget it. Hold up. This is Rabbi Friedman, who just made the initial light. So these are the actual Megara sheets. Jason, okay. We're getting out of a different story. Let's have a team of us divided into sectors. Okay, the team of Megara is getting out. Okay, so while we're waiting for the Makaros to be distributed, those who have the Makaros already, you can take a glance at source number one, where the Rambam describes the calibration of Tzchok. Take a look at source We'll skip source number two. So that about take a look at source number. Take a look at source number 5 and 6. 5 and 6 are the two stages of the Aaron's relocation. Source number 5, for those who have the sheets, line number 2, I boldfaced the word misachakim. They were dancing. Source number 6, look at the word simcha, please, line number 1. And notice the evocative symbols of Tzva Yizbach and David Chagur Eifod Ba, Betruo Vekol Shofar. Those who walked in a little bit late, don't worry, you're not late. The Mekarish just arrived. And we're describing, before we address the modality of Talmud Torah, what state of mind a person should be, and what's the role of Simcha in general. And even though the Rambam encourages a calibrated response to Tzchok, it seems as if Simcha should be unqualified. Chazal also sends that distinction. Source number 3, the Gemara described the method of preparing for davening. How should a person prepare for davening? What mind frame, what mind space, what pre-davening activities should a person engage in to set the tone? So the Gemara says in Brachos, Tana Rabbanan, Ein Omdim Lispalel, Lo Mitoch Atzvos, you shouldn't be sad. Lo Mitoch Atzvos, source 3, you shouldn't be lazy, you should be energetic. Lo Mitoch Tzchok, you shouldn't be lightheaded in davening. Lo Mitoch Sicha, you shouldn't be engaged in mindless conversation. Lo Mitoch Kalas Rosh, Lo Mitoch Devarim Betelim, Ela Mitoch Simcha Shel Mitzvah. So the Gemara discourages Tzchok as an entry point for davening, but encourages Eli Simcha Shel Mitzvah. So Chazal were keenly aware of the distinction between Tzchok and Simcha, the same distinction that emerges from the first failed relocation of the Aaron, which was David and his party Misachakim, as opposed to source number 6, the second phrase, where they were Misamchim. So it's safe to say that in general, Simcha, in Avodas Hashem, and of course in psychological well-being, is something we endorse, something which is an unqualified benefit to human experience in general, to Avodas Hashem in particular. Of course, this is the message that HaKadosh Baruch Hu chides us with in source number 4, when he announces the advent of the Tochacha and all the suffering. Part of the reason we suffer, a very famous pasuk, Tachas Asher Lo Avadata, Es Hashem Elokecha B'Simcha Uvituv Levav Mirov Kol. That the Tochacha will be invited upon you for your failure to build a relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu based on Simcha. Notice Simcha here is also qualified. We may get back to this. It's not just Simcha, but Simcha and Tov Levav. So can you achieve Simcha without Tov Levav? Possibly. What are those to refer to? So this ends our introduction. Those who have walked in a little bit late. We're here tonight to discuss what role should Simcha play in the experience of Talmud Torah, not in the experience of celebrating ceremoniously the conclusion of the Torah. When a person sits and studies Torah, what role should Simcha play? There are 4 potential problems and challenges to Simcha during the experience of Talmud Torah. Number 1, Torah is not just a text detached from time and place. It's a text that is pivoted and fastened to a pivotal moment in human history and, of course, in Jewish history. And when we study Torah, we're not just studying information, but we're trying to reenact that experience. That's, of course, the moment of Har Sinai. Har Sinai wasn't just a logistical delivery. Har Sinai was a delivery of Torah in a context that's much broader than the text itself. There's a context to Har Sinai. It wasn't just the delivery of a book. It was mass revelation, the first and only time in history that HaKadosh Baruch Hu revealed himself directly to human beings, not through dreams, not through intermediaries, not a single person, but 3 million people strong stood at Har Sinai, jointly corroborating each other's experience. It was a moment in which the infinite, incoherent word of HaKadosh Baruch Hu was translated to human form. That itself is a novel idea, that something so infinite and ethereal and non-physical, and Hashem doesn't even speak in words. He doesn't have intellect the way we have intellect. We have to clothe our ideas in words. We've got to conjugate ideas with words. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is all will. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is all essence, all reality. How can HaKadosh Baruch Hu translate that essence into words that are digestible to the human imagination? So it was an epic moment. And every time we open a sefer, we want to climb our way back to Har Sinai to remember the source of our belief, to remember that one claim that no other religion will ever stake. We can't prove Judaism empirically more than you can prove any other religion. Religion isn't empirical, it's faith-based. Empirical study can elucidate what faith affirms, but it has to begin with faith. And it's likely that Christian traditions are true, and it's likely that Islamic traditions are true because they've stood the test of time. They've been transferred generation to generation. The question is not the methodology of transition, or how it was transferred, or transmission, but what the traditions state. Christianity states that Jesus walked on water and had disciples who thought he was God. I can fully accept the fact that he walked on water. He was a magician. I can fully accept the fact that he healed people. He was a healer. I can fully accept that he had students that thought he was God. I wish my students thought that every day. So those are traditions which are completely consonant with denying the validity of Christianity as a religion. I completely ascribe to the notion that Muhammad had a dream one night in which God commanded him to conquer the world and convert them to a different religion. It's been passed on through thousands of generations. Many people have those dreams. Most of them are in the puzzle house. But those traditions don't necessarily... I can't prove Harsinai. It's not empirically provable. But if I accept Harsinai through its transmission, then we lay a claim that no other religion dares to claim, that we spoke to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in an unmediated, non-intermediary fashion. 3 million people directly heard the voice of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And if we accept that, I can't prove it empirically, but if we make that leap of faith, then every statement issued at Har Sinai is reality, is truth. It can't be debunked by signs and omens and symbols and events and historical terms. So studying Torah is a chance to recreate Har Sinai. Har Sinai had many modalities to it. It was joyous, it was festive, it was historical, it was cataclysmic. There are many different versatile experiences. But if there's one emotion which dominated Har Sinai, it was fear. Not the knee-buckling fear of terror and physical harm, but the awe of coming into contact with a being that the human imagination just can't grasp. Har Sinai was an attempt to debunk idolatry, and there are no visuals and no optics, and it was auditory, but it wasn't visual. The only visuals were smoke and clouds and billowing plumes, and wasn't visual, because Yerushalayim was being established, not the Yerushalayim of fear, but the Yerushalayim of awe, of incomprehensibility, of inscrutability, and we were unsettled. We were frightened. We were destabilized. It wasn't a comfortable experience for us. And if our attempt to study Torah is to reenact Har Sinai, then can Simcha cohere with a Sinai-like experience? So, practically, there were two very interesting regulations of Talmud Torah based on the attempts to reenact Har Sinai. For about 1,500 years, it was forbidden to study Torah when you were sitting. It must stand. The Gemara Megillah, source number 10, says, Mimos Moshe ve'ad Rabban Gamliel, lo hayu lemeidin Torah ela me'umad. They stood at attention, because at Har Sinai everyone stood. No chairs at Har Sinai, no box seats. Everyone was standing at attention, reverence. And Talmud Torah was intended to recreate Har Sinai. You are not allowed to sit. At a certain point towards the close of the second Beis HaMikdash, this became untenable. And it compromised the experience of Talmud Torah. Can you imagine standing every time you'd study Torah? And then there was another takana, which even predated, or probably didn't predate it, but men were not allowed to study Torah after engagement in marital experiences. A Baal Keri was prohibited for Torah study until he dipped in the mikveh. The Gemara tries to tease this out from a pasuk, source number 11 in Brachos, Ve'odatam, Levanecha, Levnei Vanecha, Yom Asher Amarat Alfei Hashem Elokecha B'Chorev. If Talmud Torah is an attempt to flavor Chorev in the room, what's got to be Chorev like? Chorev like wasn't walk in the park. Chorev like wasn't relaxed or casual or cavalier or content. We're unsettled. So in the end, the Gemara fails to derive it from a pasuk, and it ends up being a takan of Ezra. Ezra returns from Babel, tries to reinvigorate Talmud Torah. He also is fighting rampant intermarriage, so there's an intermarriage component to this, and he's trying to kill two birds with one stone, essentially. He's trying to get them to distance themselves from the Gentile wives, and also to re-emphasize the solemnity and the gravitas of Talmud Torah. So you can imagine the men in this room, you basically have to dip into the mikveh with greater frequency, and not just chassidim. Anytime you want to open a sefer, you have to be as pure as possible, at least from the Tomb of Baal Keri. And that also fell. That also was suspended because practically it just didn't enable successful and sustained Torah learning. So if we're trying to create Har Sinai, can Simcha and joy cohere with Har Sinai's moments, with Har Sinai's emotions? And I mentioned the suspension of Ezra's Takana, Baal Keri doesn't have to go to the mikvah, and the suspension of Rabbi Gamliel, or during Rabbi Gamliel's period, you could sit when you're learning, but there was one experience that still tried to recapture Har Sinai. What experience recaptures Har Sinai and is laced with awe, attention, reverence, solemnity? What experience is this? Hakel. See, Hakel in our imagination, and in the modern imagination, is a hustle bustle of hundreds of thousands of Jews at the Kotel, and you can barely move and you get pushed in all directions. We know that feeling. Wow, that was sweaty Israelis pushing you on all sides. Simchas Beis HaShoeva. It wasn't what Hakel was. Hakel was a gathering that tried as closely as possible to mimic Har Sinai. After apologies, I quoted the Rambam, source number 12, but I didn't quote the beginning of the Rambam. I try to make these sources as brief as possible. The Rambam describes Hakel. I'm reading about seven words which don't appear on the sources. I'll read them slowly if you want to write them down or at least digest them. The Rambam describes Hakel, lishmoa, to listen to Torah, Bi'ema v'yira, ema and yira, fear and awe, v'gilu birada, and the joy of discomfort, gilu birada, kiyom shenitna bo b'sinai, just like it was given in Har Sinai. Then the Rambam concludes, source number 12, shelo kava ha-katov el l'chazeg das ha-emes. The purpose of Hakel is not really cognitive, it's more experiential. V'ira atzmo, line 2, this is the punchline, key line, money shot in the Rambam. V'ira atzmo, line 2, source 12, kilo ata nitztavabo, as if you're receiving it this moment, and that's why the agent of delivery, who do you think the agent would be? It's the melech, because the melech can install as closely as possible at a human level those dosages of fear or discomfort. Melech in monarchies has that type of absolute power to decide life and death. The Rambam concludes, "Shehamelech shliachu lashmiya divrei Hakel." In theory, the Melech was selected over someone who may have been a bigger Talmid Chacham, because we're not looking for the person that can deliver the best risk or share. We're looking for the person that can be a stand-in or an understudy for HaKadosh Baruch Hu's role in Har Sinai. And the Melech can play that role most accurately. So, if we're trying to recreate Har Sinai, can that, not the mirth, and those who came in a little bit late, I spoke about the difference between schok, which is lightheadedness, and joy, and humor, and relaxation, which I think are all important in life, and simcha, which is inner contentment, serenity, tranquility, gratification, a sense of alignment. Har Sinai is not meant, and if we're returning to that moment, what role should simcha play? The second challenge of simcha during Talmud Torah is not just the place we return to, but the being we try to connect to. Talmud Torah is not just studying text. We want to tunnel our way to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There are many ways we try to interface with Hashem. We dive into Hashem. We live in His land. We build His people and His history. We try to mimic His moral essence. We fulfill His commands. We try to fashion ourselves into obedient slaves. But the closest we can come is to study His directly revealed will, because everything else is a human convention. Philosophy is a human convention. The employment of human terms trying to describe HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it's flawed. For some it's helpful, for some it's meaningless, but it's always flawed because the entire lexicon is human-based, and a human-based lexicon is incompatible with the divine. But Torah is His will. By definition, Moshe Feinstein knew more about Hashem than Albert Einstein, because he wasn't decoding God through His creation. He was listening to God's direct interview. So we're trying to find HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's a theological moment. It's a chance to reach out and interact with Rabbanu Shalom. And perhaps the pasuk which best captures this is the pasuk, source number 13, at least the way it's interpreted by Chazal. B'chol ha-makom asher azikir ha-shini avoy lecha v'rachticha. The first part of the pasuk speaks about the unique ceremonies and rituals in the Beis HaMikdash, mizbach adama ta'asali, v'zavachta alavas alasecha v'shlomecha, Beis HaMikdash, mizbeach, korbanos. But then Hashem assures us He may not be a Kohen, He may not have a Beis HaMikdash. B'chol ha-makom asher azikir ha-shini avoy lecha v'rachticha. No matter where you are, just call my name and I'll be there. Avoy lecha. Very frontal. Avoy lecha v'rachticha. Now, how do you call Hashem's name? Well, the phrase Shem Hashem is a metaphor. My name is Moshe. If, let's say, you lobotomize me and change my name into David overnight, it wouldn't change who I am. It'd be a little awkward tomorrow, but I get used to it. I'd still be the same person, same values, same traits, same family, same. Wouldn't really change much. But Moshe is the way people refer to me. Instead of saying, you over there in the black suit, you go, Moshe, and I answer. So it's an access point. It's where you access me. Moshe, and I respond. Similarly with Torah. Hashem's essence is in Torah. Hashem spans beyond Torah. But it's the way we access Him, and that's why it's called Shem Hashem. Anyone know where else Torah is referred to? A second point in the Torah. Once in Parshas Yisrael, B'chol HaMakom Asher Azkir Ashimi Yavor Alecha V'Rechticha. Where else? Ki Shem Hashem Akra, HaMakotel Elokein, HaPasik and Hazino, which is the source for Berachas HaTorah. When you learn Torah, Ki Shem Hashem Akra, HaMakotel Elokein, the only two Berachas, which are Deoraisa, Berachas HaTorah and Berachas HaMazon. So B'chol HaMakom Asher Azkir Ashmi, in that vein, is interpreted as anytime you read Torah, I'm there. And this is how Chazal interpreted in a very famous passage in Perkei Avos. Source number 14 and 15. Rabbi Chalafta Ishkvar Hanani Omer, Asara Sheyoshin Boskin Batara Shechina Benem. 10 people will learn Torah, engage with the Shechina. 5 people will learn Torah, engage with the Shechina. 3 people will learn Torah. Uminayin, Afilu Echad, source number 15. How do you know that even one person who studies Torah is engaging with the Shechina? Shinemar, b'chol ha-makom asher azkir ashni, avoy lach o'verachticha. And that's the second challenge of Simcha. Studying Torah is walking into a different realm. It's not your province. It's a different domain. It's the domain of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And when I enter that realm, should my passport read Simcha, or should it read something more solemn combination? Let me give you a halachic example for the fact that Torah is entering a different domain, a different realm. Can a Rebbe be mochel his kavod? A father can be mochel his kavod. Can a Rebbe be mochel his kavod? At the core of this question is, whose Torah is it? Is the Rebbe just a link, a transmission? In which case, it's not his kavod due him. It's not Kadosh Baruch Hu's kavod, and therefore it can't be waived, it can't be neglected, it can't be surrendered. This was the source of a very interesting debate amongst two Amoraim in the Gemara in Kiddushin, source 17. Harav shemachal al kavodo, en kavodo machal. Rav Yosef omer, afilu harav shemachal al kavodo, kavodo machal. Now, the axis of this debate was an intriguing pasuk in the beginning of Tehillim. Because Tehillim mentions the man, the fortunate man who doesn't fall into the company of wicked, doesn't adhere to the naysayers and the demagogues, Moshe Vleitzim, Asher Hayish Asher Lo Alach Batzas Rishayim, Uvedera Chatayim Lo Amad, he doesn't walk in the path of the sinners. And what's the next pasuk? Source number 16, second pasuk. Kiim, what is the, remember, Tehillim starts backwards. Tehillim is a backwards book. Asher Hayish Asher Lo Alach, rather than Aror Hayish Asher Halach. David doesn't want to start dealing with the word Aror. He doesn't want to start the word dealing with a curse. So he writes, Asher Hayish Asher Lo Halach Batzas Rishayim Uvedara Chatayim Lo Amad Uvemoshev Leitzim Lo Yashav. And then he provides his prescription for success. Ki im B'toras Hashem Chetzo. He desires Hashem's Torah. So the first presentation is that the Torah is owned possessively by Hashem. And then this pasuk flips. Uvitaraso yehege yomam v'layla. Who is the taraso referring to? What's the antecedent? The ish. So whose Torah is it? Is it Hashem's Torah, Taras Hashem? Or is it taraso, the Torah of that ish? Ask yourself, you've all worked in Torah. You've all spent hours. You all feel as if you've personalized it. Is it really yours? Now, of course, at an existential level, those two modalities don't clash. They're both. Part of what makes Torah so appealing is that it's a merging of two different realms, and it's a merging of the human spirit and HaKadosh Baruch Hu's will. And for that day in the Beis Medrash, you can't have it both ways. Halacha is binary. Experience is versatile. But halacha has to be, is it Taras Hashem, and therefore the Rebbe can't be mochel? Or is it Taraso? Is it his Torah, and therefore he's deserving of the honor, and he can be mochel? And the Gemara advances these two positions. The end of source 17. Hacha, sorry, source 18. Hacha, Torah Dilehi? Is it his Torah, the Rebbe? Hadar Amar Rava, and then Rava flipped and reversed. In Torah Dilehi. So Rava was deliberating these two words in the Pasuk. But when we study Torah, we're entering a different realm. In fact, Rabbi Soloveitchik famously suggests a very, very provocative idea. that the nature, halachically, of a birchas haTorah, the bracha recited before studying Torah, that the nature of a birchas haTorah is akin to a birchas hanenin. Just like when I eat an apple, I have to recite a bracha to be matir the apple, because before the bracha isn't mine, Lashem haaretz umloa, it doesn't belong to me, and if I eat that apple without a bracha, I'm a thief. Similarly, if I study Torah without making a bracha, I'm a thief. I've entered a realm without permission, without authorization. And that's why it has to precede the Talmud Torah, and that's why the Gemara says in Brachos Yud Aleph, if you wake up early in the morning before davening, you still have to make a bracha as a matir for certain types of Torah, proved it from the Gemara in Brachos. So can Simcha frame this entry into a different realm? Those are the first two challenges of Simcha when we study Torah. Number one, is it compatible with Har Sinai? Number two, is it compatible with the recognition, Simcha, if it's, again, not joy and happiness, but contentment and satisfaction. It's internal, it's human, it's when we've absorbed an experience and we feel comfortable with that experience, our place in our world, our place in our families, our place in our own sense of self. But Torah is an entry into Hashem's world. And is that contentment and gratification synonymous, or at least congruent, with the entry into Hashem's domain, to Hashem's palace? So far we've itemized two potential challenges for Simcha and Talmud Torah. Number one, we're trying to return to Har Sinai. That wasn't a moment of contentment or tranquility. Number two, we're entering Hashem's realm. It's a foreign space. It's an ennobling foreign space. But we're ascending to a different location in our space, in our minds, in our hearts. The third challenge is motivation. Torah is very powerful. By definition, it's divinely empowered. It's divine jet fuel. And Chazal were aware that it could be used just as it could be abused. V'samtem es devarayla, Chazal, take that pasuk as a code to sam zacha nasalo sam chayim. Lo zacha nasalo sam mavis. It could be an elixir, and it could be toxic. It can lead to arrogance. It can lead to self-aggrandizement. It can lead to perversion, distortion, kavod, money, honor, ego, positioning, social. Or in the horrifying words of Chazal, a kardam lach borbo, an axe or a hoe to peddle your own affairs, your own interests, your own agenda. So when we study Torah, it's a question of not just where we are heading historically and who we're encountering theologically, but internally. Let's say for a moment Har Sinai were off the table. Was it important to recreate Har Sinai? But it's so powerful, do we approach Torah with the proper motivation? And if Torah is joyful, or at least if Torah is intellectually stimulating and conveys that sense of engagement, and is that consistent with Torah Lishma? This is something addressed by the person who is most obsessed or preoccupied with Torah Lishma, Reb Chaim Volozhin. Reb Chaim Volozhin, the founder of the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva, known as the Volozhin Yeshiva, called the mothership of all modern yeshivas. Every yeshiva today, whether it's a yeshiva down the block in Me'er Sharim or yeshiva down the road in Gush Etzion, every modern yeshiva has DNA of the Volozhin Yeshiva. That was the first modern yeshiva, probably since the Spanish era. Jews had learned in small little Bate Medrash with the local Rav. If you outgrew the local Rav, you went to the next city, the bigger city, and went with that Rav. There were a couple of yeshivas that sprouted up, but a convening of people from across large spaces to learn under one roof and ultimately to provide food for them and dormitories for them and not just to allow them to be off on their own and offer them rabbanim and a room to sit in. That all stems from the Volozhin Yeshiva under the inspiriting of the Vilna Gaon. Chaim Volozhin was a Talmud of the Vilna Gaon. So, in his sefer called Nevesh HaChaim, which has become the Bible of the Yeshiva world, because it asserts very boldly the surpassing value of Torah, and there's nothing more important in this world than Talmud Torah. It doesn't just affect our own experience, not just our own world, but supernal worlds and cosmic realities. And in Volozhin, they took the Gemara and the Dharm very seriously, that if Torah wouldn't be studied for 1 minute, the world would collapse, which I believe is true, because this world isn't here for material or politics or headlines or nations or wars or sports. It's here for the presence of Hashem, and the presence of Hashem is best conveyed through Torah. But when I go to sleep, I know that people in, I don't know, Los Angeles are waking up to learn, if they want to go to sleep. In Volozhin, they took it dead serious. In Volozhin, they assigned shifts, like in the army. So you have to learn from 2 to 3, and you have to learn from 3 to 4, and you have to learn from 5 to 6, and you have to learn from 1 to the graveyard shift, because it was on them to keep the world afloat, to sustain the world. So in his Sefer Nefesh HaChaim, which is written as a polemic against Hasidus, because Hasidim were toying with the concept of Lishma. To them, Torah was studying for some higher spiritual experience, and for him, Torah was studying just to engage in the content itself. When you're learning a Tosfos, you need every morsel of mental and emotional energy to crack the code. So you're dedicating some of that energy to an experiential moment, to feel Hashem's presence. So you're saying, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, sit down. I need to focus on Tosfos right now. Stop bothering me. I need to get your Tosfos. And to get your Tosfos, I can't be thinking about you right now. I have to be thinking about your Tosfos. It's a compelling question. But in his Ruach Chaim, which is the Sefer he wrote in Pirkei Avos, which is source number 22, and it's Ruach HaChaim, he wrestles with this question of Torah Lishma. He writes, Hinei belimud yesh kama pinios. There are many different side motives. Lavas mamon, monetary profit, kavod, honor. V'yesh alome ne'avas chachmasa. Line number 3. For some, it's just intellectual. Gam ha'mispalsim yod. Even philosophers would agree. Kikol ha'chachmas heima kimar midli neged ha'mukus chachmas ha'talmud. Compared to Torah, all the other disciplines wane. So here's his resolution. If you are lishma, and by the way, you happen to enjoy it, don't worry. Your primary motive is religious. And what can you do if consequently you also enjoy it? It's not ideal, but it's inevitable. And what's primary and what's secondary? What's the thrust and what's ancillary? We'll see. Another 18th century Polish figure greatly, greatly alter the sequencing. But Reb Chaim places his finger squarely upon the issue. Why am I sitting to learn? Because it's enjoyable? Not jovial and light, it's hard, but it creates a sense of satisfaction. Or amenas lasos, to fulfill mitzvahs, to get close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to understand his will. And the simcha can perhaps blur the differences. And that's the third concern of simcha. It's interesting because throughout history there are many who raise concerns of whether we should be happy when we study Torah, but they didn't make it into the svarim. Most of them were excised in the svarim. So I'm just summarizing the issues that could emerge. The first concern is trying to trace ourselves back to Har Sinai. The second concern is trying to enter a realm beyond our human realm, the realm of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The third concern is motivation. Am I studying to be motivated religiously, or is it, as we would say, self-serving and self-directed and inward turning? The fourth concern is not motive, but sustaining the rigor of Torah study. Torah study isn't easy. It takes discipline. It takes commitment. It takes persistence. Generally, when we're trying to discipline ourselves towards taxing and even overwhelming experiences which we deem valuable, it's not because we enjoy them. It's because we render them valuable and important and we commit ourselves to those tasks. And at what point, if a person is searching for simcha in Torah, at what point will that diminish discipline, commitment, stick-to-itiveness? If you interview your average masvid and say, does this cause you simcha? You may say, it's hard. I'm stretching my limits. I'm pushing myself sleep deprived and I'm working hard and my demon is valuable, it's eternal, and I'm willing to sacrifice some inner simcha for something larger than my own identity or my own situation. The Gemara describes, source number 19, Gemara describes how a person should approach Talmud Torah. Liolam yisim adam asma al divrei Torah. Nice duality. Kishor liol, source 19, ukechamor lamasui. Like an ox with a yoke and a donkey with a weight. So the common denominator is heavy, taxing, difficult. exhausting. There's a difference. First of all, the donkey has an acute weight, whereas the shor is not as acute. The donkey is working and schwitzing hard. The shor is using its body mass to pull. You don't feel that same effort. And sometimes there are moments of acute work in Talmatar. You really don't understand something and it bothers you when you work at something and you're not feeling well and you feel like, I've got to find the inner donkey. I've got to be the donkey here. I've got to carry this weight. It's hard. I don't understand it. It troubles me. It's important to understand that I'm not at my best right now. How can I find the resources? Sometimes it's just the day-to-day to finish the daf and have to finish the mishnayos that I committed to. And I just want to make sure that my dosage in Torah, my speedometer keeps increasing in Talmud Torah. The second difference is, I think a masoi is physical and an ol is also psychological. When you're carrying something on your neck, even when you're at rest, there's a choker. You feel as if you're under some larger commitment. And Jew lives a committed, mandated life. And that sense of commitment and calling is nowhere more pronounced than in Talmud Torah, because it's so overwhelming, and it can drown you. And it can... So I remember my children, when they were little, would walk into my svarim room, lined with svarim on either side, and say, Abba, when are you going to finish? I said, probably never. Not even close. And that could either be enticing and intriguing to pursue the elusive, and to never catch it, to never apprehend it, or it can be very frustrating, taxing mentally, psychologically. I think we've all hit that point in Torah, especially in Torah Shebaal Peh. Tanakh, and Baruch Hashem, there are many great shirim in Tanakh this evening, but if you work hard enough, and you reach beachhead pretty quickly. There are layers that you can still uncover, but there's a sense of satisfaction. What the text says, what the information is, things are organized. Shas is chaotic. Shas is a swirling vortex of variables and ideas and clashes and symmetries, and sometimes just to reach beachhead, just to, base camp, takes hours and hours. That's not even climbing Mount Everest. You're getting to base camp. Just getting to the base camp, setting up the tent, could take you 10, 12 hours. And your average difficult sugya. That's why Chazal speak of it. Very interesting homily. Source number 21. Who would have thought that Talmud Torah, maybe this is a good way to convince you that it's not all just simcha. Who would have thought that a pasuk in Eicha refers to Talmud Torah? But yet the Gemara in Sanhedrin superimposes an Eicha pasuk. What does it say in Eicha? Paragimo? Bamachashakim Hoshivani Kimei Seolam. You can just see Yirmiyah sitting right down the street in his sackcloth, right out here looking at Yerushalayim and crying, Hashem, you've placed me in the darkness like the dead of this earth. Then a couple hundred years later, Chazal says, oh, that refers to people who study Gemara. Zithal Mubavli. The newsflash. It's true. It's not dark in a bleak and gloomy sense, but it's a tunnel. And it's taxing. And if the impetus for Talmud Torah is simcha and contentment, at what point will a person walk away when it doesn't cause at least that immediate contentment, that immediate gratification? I would think, and I'm thrilled with the popularity of Tanakh and the rising resurgent popularity, but I would imagine that some of the popularity is because it's less difficult. Part of it is we're back in the country, part of it is themes that we haven't thought about and inspected for. But Yeshiva Har Etzion runs a Tanakh Yimei Yun during the summer for a week, and about 4,500 people walk into the building. I sometimes wonder if we ran a Yimei Yun B'Tanakh on the Gemara Bava Basra, how many people would show up. One thing I know for sure, not 4,500 people. It's hard. It's taxing. Those are the four challenges towards studying Talmud Torah purely from a position of or modality of simcha. Now, I have to issue not a disclaimer, but a conditional qualification. I think the first two are more severe. The last two can more easily be calibrated. You could more easily merge simcha with lishma, either in the manner of the Chaim Volozhin, your primary focus is serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and the secondary ramifications are joy, or to be able to sense simcha in serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that contentment, that gratitude. I'm not sure that they're irreconcilable. Certainly that last part, if simcha, we grow through life and we grow and we learn the difference between happiness and meaning, and if we choose happiness, we'll probably not ever achieve it. If we achieve meaning, we'll probably have both. At a certain point, meaning, contentment, and the deeper the struggle, the more the meaning, the more the contentment, the more the formative, So it's easier to reconcile simcha with those last two concerns, the concern of motivation and the concern of how long you'll sustain Talmud Torah. It's a little more tricky to reconcile, I think it's still feasible, simcha and Talmud Torah with that return to Har Sinai and the moments of Har Sinai. And certainly entering a realm of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which isn't our realm. It's still doable because I think human beings are multifaceted. We're not one-dimensional. We're not binary. There are moments in Talmud Torah we'll feel Har Sinai. There are moments of Talmud Torah we'll feel content and gratified. And there are moments we'll feel we're in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's realm and we're unsettled by it. There are moments we'll feel that we've conquered Torah and personalized Torah. But I think those two first concerns are more primary, whereas those last two concerns are concerns that should be acknowledged but are easier to synchronize with our experience of Talmud Torah. But what are the advantages of Simcha Talmud Torah? Right? There's no black and white answer here, but what are the advantages? How does Simcha facilitate Talmud Torah? So I want to talk about three very brief opportunities for Simcha. Probably the most audacious statement of the value of Simcha in Talmud Torah was issued by Rav Avram Borenstein, known as the Avnei Nezer, the Igle Tal, Sachachov, son-in-law of the Kotzk, talking about Rav Chaim Volozhin, who had entry to the sequestered Vilna Gaon. He was one of the only people, Rav Avram Borenstein, who had access to the sequestered Kotzker Rebbe. The Kotzker Rebbe withdrew from his yeshiva, locked himself in a room to achieve purity. Somehow his son-in-law was the one who he gained access to. He started the Hasidus of Sachachov. The son of the Avnei Nezer was Hashem Yishmuel. So just those of you following the Hasidic lineage. So in a very famous statement in the Igle Tal, this is source number 23, Shamati k'tzas b'nei adam toim midarach haseichel. There's some idiots. B'nyin lima tarasenu akadosha. V'yamru ke'al lo medu mechadesh chidushim v'sameach misanig b'limudo. If you're happy when you're learning, ein zu lima natara kol kach lishma. He addresses the first concern. He says, line number 4, V'emes, zetas meforsam. This is a known error. The Adarabba, he flips the script. Adarabba, not just am I going to defend that Simcha is passable, Adarabba. Here's this key line. Zehi ikar mitzvas limud Torah. Ikar mitzvas limud Talmud Torah is the Simcha that Torah provides. The question he doesn't address is why. And I want to suggest, I want to quote three different approaches. One from a 14th century French rabbi, and two from a 20th century Lithuanian rabbi. Rabbeinu Avram Minahar, Rabbeinu Avram of Montpellier. I killed that, but someplace with more culture than myself. Okay, 14th century Rabbeinu Avram articulates it as follows, source number 24. Okay. Source number 24, line, thank you, Rabbi Avram. Source number 24, line 3. Avon or adjunct. But this is an eternal mitzvah. It's Tzadik Hashem's word, and to believe in it. And how do you reach deeper levels of belief? We have to let land. We all believe in a Hirschbach. We all believe in Torah. But there are different levels of belief. And it can't be quantified. Well, I believe 70%, the 30% of the guy don't believe is how essential is it? How much does it become your will? How internal does it become? Does it become something that lands or settles within your identity to the deepest core of who you are? Does it cause that sense of last night I was in the circle with the a lot of people in the circus, I want every large guests, a lot of those guests, I have like a round robin question for everyone to the circus. So I'm saying everyone go around the table tells what makes you happy or not. What gives you contentment? What I have to say, a little piece. So what gives me contentment is like your religion and life merge. And it's all straight and smooth. I don't feel like I'm two people. And I'm always religious and I'm always living. And sometimes I'm here and sometimes I'm there, but I feel like it's one line rather than a curve. Or waxing and waning. So since Torah is intellectual and existential, if it doesn't cause contentment, then you're still dissonant. It's not really part of you. You don't feel completely comfortable. It's not your skin. There's some other part of you that you have to give it up.
And then there's a superimposition of some rule of God or will of God, and you're walking around with two parts and they're not completely integrated. And when it lands and it settles, and Bhakti would somehow come in somewhere, you say, this is how I view life. This is, it makes sense. And this is something that causes me contentment and serenity and calmness and inner peace. I know that I'm doing something of meaning. And read it again. Mitzvos limot she'inyan tzir ha'leif. That's your MO. I can study math, but math is a world. Math is a religious. There's no religious component to math. Let me take a few more minutes because of the numbers. Since we're short of time, I'll just briefly describe two issues which your footwork talking about in these topics. The first issue, which Rabbeinu Rami Nahar, remember, the Igmei Tal asserted the importance of happiness. It's simply to explain why. The 14th century French rabbi Rabbeinu Rami Nahar talked about being an internal subscription, subscribing to an idea. You're trying to internalize that idea, and you internalize it when it causes, when it aligns as part of your essence. Pater Yitzchak in Chanukah speaks about how do we acquire information? It's more epistemological, it's not just religious. How do we study? What role does curiosity play in study? What role does wonder play in study? What role does marvel play in study? When we're looking for information, we're trying to explore our world, or we express our curiosity, and we feel passionate about something, we tend to engage more deeply, we tend to follow more thoroughly, we research more assiduously, we're interested. There's a part of acquisition of knowledge, not just knowledge. Epistemology, how to acquire, assemble knowledge, part of that is wonder, part of it is marvel. We're living in a world which we replace marvel in shallow screens and keep it in. We don't marvel so much. Science has eliminated marvel. We've got not much wonder, we're not intrigued, and a little bit of shallowness, and it's harder for us to access. So our partner writes, and I'll end with this one if you're going to partner writes, source number 25 says, keep it. You can't understand something. We have to connect to that. And how do you connect to that? Line number four. The power of joy, wonder. What do you call it? Joy, wonder, engagement, interest, intrigue. I feel that in the firm world today, there's a shrinking of human interest and curiosity. We're not as curious as we should be. We're very content just looking at our at the four qubits we inhabit and reinforcing them, which is important, but we're not really opening our blinders to some important issues that can enrich and leaven who we are as people. We're leavening bread and lift and create thrust and heft rather than one dimensional shallow flatline. And the second issue from the proponent speaks about, and then the blinders at the 955, is not about how you acquire information, but how you remember information. Memory is not just of intellectual skill, memory is what we care about. Son of the last boy, tell me the puzzles you learned in high school 3 months ago, and he came to begin to identify. Well, tell me the score of the jet ski 3 months ago. Yeah, I got that story down. How many stats do you remember? So you care about it. Don't forget your birthday. So obviously, memory is not just an intellectual acumen, it's also a decision. And memory is not just tricks to the number, but how deeply we've internalized information at the get go. Things that are very formative and transformative and deeply touch us. We don't forget that. And if we're excited about what we're learning, because generally when we're emotional about experiences, then our minds flow more directly to our hearts. When there's excitement, either happiness or sadness, we break out of that rigid reality, the nebulous reality we spend our lives walking through. All of a sudden, there's a high pitch of excitement or a low moment, but those are the times we never must, because the emotional stamp creates memory retention. It's an emotional stamp. I remember that time was really sad. Remember that time was really enthralled. And if those moments are associated with Talmud Torah, the Torah will seep in more deeply and be more easily retained. So this is our last source number 26. Shekol hamakas haklita shel dvar Torah teket rishon rishon l'shaknisis hakarim. If Torah is absorbed, eino nasis el mitoch vidoy hatanik. If you're happy and engaged, then you'll be able to retain it because it infiltrates or percolates towards people not yourself. So obviously there's no answer to this, and obviously one should enjoy Simchas Torah, and it's not studying Torah, we're celebrating the role of Torah, the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the honor of Torah, the beauty of Torah, but not Monday, but Tuesday. Tuesday you're sitting in front of the Gemara. Tuesday you're sitting in front of the Shulchan Aruch. What role should Simcha play? Not an easy question. There are four challenges, but I think, obviously, many modern thinkers in the modern world were able to deconstruct the human psyche and be more aware of the different parts of human psychology. But people like David Mertal and people like Rav Hochman were aware that a lot of joy, not lightness in our world, not contentment and engagement and marvel and serenity to our just own self.
The remainder of the English shiur for this evening are in room 201, simple place up.
How are you?
Very good. It's good to see you at Sakaf the other day.